coming up.
Almost like a hook or
like a cord,
like a wire or like a hanger.
Into the cervix.
Into the cervix, into the uterus. Trying.
So that's the mouth of the womb.
Yes,
that's not the vagina. It goes into the vagina, into the cervix, and then...
Yeah, and then obviously trying to, again, like not sure what the gestation or how far the pregnancy was, but almost trying to like remove the contents of the womb, of the intestine, of the uterus.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic, six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. Today we're going to be discussing a few very, very controversial and interesting topics. My first question to all of you at home: would you rather have HIV or diabetes? It's a question on all of our minds, and today we're going to get into it.
How about none? Nothing. I'll be fine.
So today's episode, we don't have any special outside guests. It's just us gents. And we're happy to have Vish joining us here. He hasn't been here in a while. How's it, Vish?
Hey, how's it? Nice to be here. I feel like I'm a guest here today.
Good to have you back.
Like a guest.
We're gonna have Vish as our honorary guest today. So let's get into it. Let's start off by talking about diabetes and sexual health. Nas, you want to start? Give the people some insight.
Let's start from the beginning. What is diabetes? Because like the basic stuff we need to know, right?
Of course.
So diabetes is like when your sugar is high, right? And then why is it so high? That's the main problem. There's all different kinds of reasons why. But the main one we see, the one that everybody knows, is type 2 diabetes, right? Oh. So it's, imagine like, this is the way I like to explain it. So imagine you hear a noise, like a beeping. Like, you know, when you're on call, those machines are beeping all the time, mm-hmm. right? Or they're making a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. You hear it all the time. And when you get there initially, like it's very annoying, right? You can't handle it. But then over time, you get desensitized to it, right? That noise just disappears in the background, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Sugar makes a noise in your body, right? Mm-hmm. And your body hears it and it says, okay, I'm going to secrete insulin. And then insulin gets secreted. And then the insulin works on the body's cells and it takes that sugar from the blood into the body, right? Into the cells. So if you just keep hitting that signal of sugar all the time, the body will get desensitized, right? Mm. It'll be like, this sugar is there, but I'm not going to secrete insulin anymore.
Exactly, yeah. Mm.
Right? So you get insulin resistance.
Mm. Mm.
So we need to try and help to make the body wake up again, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's medication like metformin, right? That helps the body to wake up and say, oh, there's sugar. Let me increase my sensitivity to it. Wake up again and take it in, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes the sugar is so high, you need to just like add more noise to make the body wake up and to hear that, to take that sugar in. So you give more insulin, and that insulin just replaces the job of the pancreas and takes the sugar into the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is of high sugar, right? And that sugar causes damage to all parts of the body, the eyes, the penis, the brain,
the heart.
Yeah,
I think that's a great explanation.
That's an important one. Yeah, that's good. Mm. I think it's a good analogy. I think it got a little bit mixed up with the noise there. Because
I think the noise is the sugar.
Yeah.
The noise is the sugar, not the insulin, right? So the insulin is you trying to deal with that noise, right?
Yeah.
So if you're someone that either you have a predisposed genetic condition, which is more likely type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And that's the body's dysfunction is that it cannot produce adequate amount of insulin to take up that sugar into the cells. And if you can't use sugar for energy in your cells, you can have catastrophic problems because you can have a lot of sugar floating in your blood,
mm-hmm.
but none of it is in the cells. Mm-hmm. And so your heart requires sugar via energy to pump, your breathing, your organs for survival, all of them. Your brain requires energy in order to produce all of its functions. Mm-hmm. And so when you don't have that, when you don't have insulin to take it into your cells, that's when you're going to have all these negative effects. Right? That's type 1.
Yeah.
Type 2, Nas?
Oh, so type 1, the body's pancreas doesn't secrete insulin, right?
Yeah.
Type 2, the body's...
The autoimmune disorder.
Autoimmune disorder. Yeah. So your body attacked the B cells and you don't secrete insulin anymore, right?
That's type 1.
Type 1. Yeah. Type 2, the body's now insulin resistant, right? There's a lot of sugar. Your body still has a pancreas that secretes insulin, but it's not enough. Right?
Mm. It's sensitized.
Desensitized.
And I think another very important thing to remember, because I mean, someone else would think, okay, but now I have this accumulation of sugar in my blood vessels. I mean, how does my heart get damaged? How does my kidney and my eyes get involved? So on a sort of a cellular level, what happens is if you have an accumulation of glucose in your bloodstream, you start getting damage to the endothelial cell or the lining of the vessels. Mm. And I mean, especially the small vessels. And you have small vessels everywhere, especially supplying your heart, your eyes, your kidneys, you know, and your penis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so what happens is that you get these vessels that get damaged. I mean, obviously, blood vessels carry oxygen. They carry blood that carries nutrients and oxygen and everything else. It's like a freeway covered in potholes. You're obviously going to have issues. You know, nothing is going to work.
I like these analogies.
but basically that's why most, especially like a generalist will tell you, get your heart checked, get your eyes checked. And the big reason why it always targets the eyes is because the oxygen demand for the eyes is quite significant.
Mm.
So you get a lot of oxygen that's supplied to the eyes and you get a lot of these microvasculature in the retina or the back of the eye. So obviously you would see most of the damage in the retina first before you would, you know, be able to see microvasculature damage in the kidney. Not to say that, you know, the kidney doesn't get affected first, but it's a good way to sort of see which target organs are being damaged.
Yeah. So yeah, the eyes, the kidney, particularly the medulla of the kidney has high oxygen requirements. Is that correct, Fish?
Yeah. So. Obviously, I mean, the kidney pretty much filters your entire intravascular volume.
Yeah.
So obviously, with poorly controlled diabetes, I mean, you can have diabetes that's well controlled, you know, and some of the systemic or the changes you may see throughout the body may not necessarily manifest itself. But obviously, poorly controlled, you may then start seeing changes where the actual tissue of the kidney becomes damaged. I mean, you can pick these things up with ultrasound, doing a Doppler or like measuring the what we would call like the flow of the blood in the renal vessels or the kidney vessels, also as a measure to check that.
Mm.
Yeah, and then obviously with blood tests you can also measure the kidney function.
Kidney function, well. Also, obviously, with high amounts of glucose flowing through the blood, some of it is going to, you know, part of the kidney's job is also filter the good stuff, or keep the good stuff in and let the bad stuff out. And a lot of the time in diabetic patients with advanced disease, the damage that happens to that filter, let's call it the filter, it begins to allow sugar to flow out of the blood volume and into the urine. And so you can't even detect glucose in the urine when you are an uncontrolled diabetic.
So sugar is running around glycating things. It can attack and join and join to things. So it's like it joins to your hemoglobin. It makes HbA1c, right? Yeah. It joins to your immune system and it creates like foam cells where your body's now like, your immune system is like attacking those little pieces of sugar, right? Mm-hmm. Attacks your nerves, it attacks your blood vessels.
Yeah.
So those potholes that you see on the road, it's like on the blood vessels, right?
Mm.
It causes those holes and then cholesterol can go and deposit into that hole, right? Then you end up getting the atherosclerosis and the narrowing of the blood vessels.
Mm.
Yeah. And then the way you feel when someone has high sugar, it's like you pee a lot, you're very thirsty and you feel tired.
And why is that? Explain why those symptoms happen.
So you pee a lot because your body has like a high concentration of sugar. It's trying to release, trying to take out that extra sugar, right? Mm. And you're also getting dehydrated. So you're feeling tired. Mm. Your body's not getting, your cells are not getting the sugar it needs for its energy.
Right? Yeah, sugar has a diuretic effect.
Yeah.
It causes you to lose water just by its nature. So because you're trying to get rid of this sugar, water moves with it.
Yeah. So I have a quick question for all of you guys. I think you actually asked this question in the beginning. Would you rather have HIV or diabetes?
Mm.
I want to know from you guys. Yeah, I mean,
would you rather have unprotected sex or chocolate every day? That's really the question that we have to get down to. Personally, look, I mean, I know it's scary, but like, if you think of the complications that you get with diabetes, the vast amount of complications you get with diabetes, and the way in which you need to treat diabetes versus HIV, which is literally a tablet a day, and you can actually live a decent quality of life. Yeah. It is really debatable because it's still a tough life.
I don't think HIV, it's debatable. I don't think it's debatable. I mean,
I just think in terms of both obviously, if you well controlled HIV positive, you know, the complications you may have or AIDS related illnesses may be, you may not actually acquire them, you may not experience them. It's the same with the type 2 diabetes. If you are very well controlled, you may not experience a lot of the complications or side effects of someone who is a non-controlled diabetic. Mm. But I think in terms of achieving that control, purely out of like observational bias, I suppose, it seems as if there's a lot more that would go into managing a diabetic than 100%. Someone who is HIV positive.
Yeah,
yeah, but the question is, what would you rather have? That's the question.
Look, I think you need to also say what if you were to have some of the complications, being an uncontrolled diabetic or being an uncontrolled HIV positive patient.
No, now you're complicating.
No, you're complicating.
If you were to get HIV or diabetes. But I'm saying, which would you rather have? Would you rather live with ED, hypertension, metabolic syndrome? Sorry, erectile dysfunction, heart attack, stroke, threatened or like septic limb, or would you rather have certain other complications like possible TB?
What's that thing?
Kaposi sarcoma.
I was thinking Kaposi.
Yeah, Kaposi sarcoma is a pretty devastating complication.
Again, like both affect everything and can affect systemically in your body.
True. But I think the question then you must ask yourself is, what do you feel like would be easier for you to treat like within yourself?
I think honestly speaking, something easier to treat would be HIV.
Fact.
I also agree. I would prefer HIV over TB. And my reasoning is...
over TB.
over diabetes. And the reason is diabetes is a silent killer, like hypertension. You know, it's not easy to detect unless if you obviously, someone who does annual checks or, you know, someone who's I mean, you need some level of understanding and education and maybe even a family history for you to detect it early. In most cases, I mean, you know, people go years diabetic and not knowing what's going on, you know.
Sure.
So there's like a lifestyle that, the short of it, it's difficult to detect. So I would rather have, you know, whereas HIV is not that difficult, especially in our country. With the prevalence of HIV, of TB, etc. Because most people actually come in coughing, and this cough that they've had, and all these constitutional symptoms of TB. And you test the TB, it's positive. You do HIV, so it's quite easy to detect HIV, especially in our setting, because of its proximity to TB.
But the thing is, you now diagnose HIV when someone comes with an opportunistic infection.
Yes.
Right? You end up getting like TB meningitis. Then you're like, now you test for HIV and you find out in a hard way, right?
True.
With diabetes, it's like, I have pee a lot. Now I think I might have sugar. So let me go and check my sugar.
I think it's just it's a debatable thing.
Yeah, let's be honest. In your 10 years of being a medical doctor, right, have you ever seen a patient who comes, it's a bit debatable, like a patient who comes with a polydipsia, polyuria, and all these polys?
Yes.
I think he's in primary healthcare. Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
More exposed.
But like, I mean, I've been also in primary healthcare and in casualties. Like, you never see patients coming.
I mean, again, like in urology, I think the main complaint would be erectile dysfunction. Yeah. And then obviously part of the workup.
That's crazy. Like people don't know that diabetes can give you erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time people actually get erectile dysfunction, then find out they have diabetes.
No, yeah, realistically. Or some patients already know and then like, what are you taking? And it's like, oh, doctor, I'm not taking any medication, but I've been diagnosed with this, you know, which I'm sure you guys often see.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Even like, I mean, within our clinic,
yeah,
we do see often a lot of patients that have poorly controlled diabetes. They often are in denial about it, aren't managing it well. And the thing is, as we said, right, I would rather have HIV because HIV doesn't require as much lifestyle modification as diabetes does. And lifestyle modification is really the hardest thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, thankfully, obviously, we are part of the Gens Clinic and we promote a healthy lifestyle. So we also try our best to
live. We're not saying get HIV instead.
Yeah, no, we're not saying that. don't go out there and just... Don't go say, yeah, like the guys in the Gens Clinic
say... Yeah, sit down. No, I'd rather I'm better off with HIV I'm than diabetes.
Let me go raw dog it.
Shy. No way. See, we're not disclaiming.
We are not advocating for any of that. What we are saying is one is definitely simply, easier to the other. And try your best to avoid getting the one because you can't. There are things that you can do to avoid getting them.
Yeah, yeah. I think put simply, it's more like if you were to have one, which would be easier to monitor or manage.
Mm. Yeah. I think the other aspect of the two diseases is like HIV. HIV can contract HIV with one mistake, whereas diabetes, you are making mistakes every day for years and years of your life.
Yeah.
That mistake of I would rather have a chocolate than have a banana or a piece of chicken.
Broccoli.
Broccoli. Yeah. In Tadla's case, broccoli. You would rather you made that decision. You woke up in the morning and said, "Nah, I'm not going to the gym today.
Yeah. I'm not exercising. Walking, I'm not doing anything."
And as time goes on, obviously your insulin resistance builds up. So there's insulin firing. Insulin is going. But it has no effect on your cells because your cells are just overloaded with sugar.
Yeah.
So it just can't do anything. And I think, for the two, it is easier to contract HIV, yes. By making one mistake, you can get HIV. Mm. But with diabetes, it's an active choice to prevent it.
And it
goes with lifestyle modification every day. And it's super hard. The reason why it's so hard to manage is because you've got people in their 50s who now have been diagnosed after having 20, 30 years of living a certain way. And now you try and tell them, no, you've got to live a different life.
Mm. Yeah. So what are the lifestyle changes people must make?
Actually, I wanted to ask you that. I'm sure that's something you have to...
Naseem, I know you have to advise a lot of people daily. Every day about this.
It's so simple. It's just sugar, right?
So is it?
Yes.
Okay, is that it?
Let's hear what patients are hearing.
The problem is when I say sugar, you think that sugar you put in your tea. That's the problem, right? So then they're going to have like tea with no sugar, but then they're going to be drinking Coke. They're going to be having processed food, McDonald's, whatever it is, all this extra junk food that are processed and have a lot of hidden sugar. That's where the main problem is. And people are like completely
oblivious
to it, right? So it's understanding.
What can people have instead of sugar?
Or sugar-containing products.
Those
Cokes, there's a lot of alternatives. So like those Coke Zero things are better. They replace sugar with aspartame, which is better, right? Just have those Diet Cokes, right? Those
but then I heard things. That aspartame can also cause cancers.
No, it's fine. Forget about it. No.
I think no.
The biggest
yes, I did hear that aspartame. I did hear that as well.
Yeah, I read a study that said aspartame, that they put as an artificial sweetener in diet drinks, they can cause...
But there's aspartame in everything, in eggs and other stuff. So it's
not, okay.
Just move into the wilderness and just live off the...
Plants.
Live off the earth, man.
But have like a low carbohydrate diet, right? So you're having less bread, less pap, less rice, you know, less pasta. Yeah.
Less simple sugar foods.
Less simple sugar, right? And have more protein. Prioritize the protein and replace the carbs with vegetables, right? So you have like there's like a DASH diet, they call it for people who have hypertension. Same thing works for diabetes. Just have protein, vegetables and low carbs, and that's enough. Mm-hmm. And there's people who go to an extreme. They'll go to like carnivore diet, right? Mm-hmm. Or they'll go to like intermittent fasting is actually good. So intermittent fasting, you don't eat for a long period of time, right? Then your body goes into like ketosis. Your body starts to secrete, it sort of gets more desensitized to sugar, right? Mm. Then your body now starts to now activate the sugar that's in your body, the glucose in the liver, right, first. Then it goes in, after that starts to metabolize the fat in the body, right? So that's a better way. So having intermittent fasting periods, as long as possible, try to skip breakfast, right? There's some people who say,
is this for one when you're already a diabetic or like to avoid?
Even diabetic.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I think it should be patient specific. Mm. You know, there's people who can't afford. Like for example, say I'm a diabetic and I'm listening to this, and I'm on insulin in the morning, and I inject myself with 20.
Yeah, so I think you need to be very clear about these things.
Eat for the rest of the day.
So I think it's patient specific,
and
maybe next time we can actually share a bit of some studies on this. I think it's quite interesting. Intermittent fasting.
Also, the diet will change if the patient has kidney disease, because obviously you can't have a high protein diet or high sodium.
So, maybe you can explain why the high protein is a problem for the kidneys.
Okay, so I mean, there's actually a lot. So obviously, the protein is a very big molecule. Just put simply, I mean, obviously, if a lot of it doesn't get absorbed, it can almost leak through the kidney. And apart from that, high protein, it's called nitrogen balance. So if you have a high protein intake, you're aiming to have a positive nitrogen balance in your body. The nitrogen obviously gets converted into ammonium, which in turn, I mean, it can also cause certain like effects like delirium or encephalopathy or liver disease as well. Mm.
If you have high buildup of that,
interesting.
So I mean, that's why.
Yeah,
I think that's why it makes dealing with diabetes so difficult. Is because of every plan has to be tailor made for your specific form of diabetes, whether you're taking insulin or not. Because if you're taking insulin, you can't do intermittent fasting.
Yeah, I know, of course.
Because your body won't be able to control your blood sugar. And if you're taking insulin, it's going to drop it drastically. I have read quite a lot of studies around the Banting diet, completely cutting out carbohydrates, as Naseem said, as a means to completely, like, there have been patients who have completely gotten off their insulin because their body does not depend on carbohydrate or glucose metabolism for their energy. So it then starts deriving energy from fat. And that's a completely different form of pathway for energy that doesn't require glucose. And therefore, if you don't require glucose, your insulin requirements aren't that high either. So it's fairly balanced.
But I mean, so we're mentioning all these different kinds of diets and things, but the one we should be advocating is a balanced diet. Just having a good balance of all those things, not that much, reduce the carbs, and it should be fine.
Yeah. And also just going back to something I think very important that you mentioned, the DASH diet. I remember when we were in family medicine, how there's actually, that plate, that diagram. Because I used to get a lot of patients who would ask you, no, doc, but when you say less rice, what do you mean? Less pap?
Yeah.
How much pap? Like a fist? You know, I actually didn't know. Cut down on this. And a lot of the times, especially in our setting, and we're dealing with a lot of poor, unprivileged patients, who can't even afford these diet cokes and these fancy things that that we teach.
Yeah.
So I mean, showing something that's visual, I think helps a lot. You know, even if it's not a steak, but they know this is my protein, and and this is how much protein I need to have, and fats and everything. Yeah. So maybe they can print it out, or we can put it up.
Mm. Yeah. So we can definitely show you guys a kind of visual representation of the diet and how to avoid that. But all in all, in conclusion, Naseem?
By the way, there's 5 types of diabetes.
Oh, yeah? Tell us all the 5 types.
Yeah. Type 1, we already mentioned, autoimmune. There's no insulin being secreted, right? Type 2 is insulin resistance. The cells are not awake to that insulin, right?
It's more of a lifestyle
disease. Type 3, was is dementia, right? So the it's basically so the people think that Alzheimer's, right, was linked to amyloid plaque in the brain.
Yes.
Right? Mm. They've now debunked that and saying it's not actually that. People still teach that, but it's actually not that. It's more linked to insulin resistance. So dementia and Alzheimer's is actually type 3 diabetes, right?
Okay.
Then there's type 4. Type 4 is in the elderly people. So as we age, our body's not working as well. So the body doesn't respond to insulin as well. So we end up getting diabetes in our old age. So that's type 4.
Mm-hmm.
Type 5 comes from like malnutrition. So people who are like malnourished in the young age, as we get older, the pancreas doesn't grow as well, and the B cells are not as active, right? So then you end up getting looks like type 1, but as a grown up a bit.
I always thought type 3 was like, you know, iatrogenic if you have a pancreatic.
I also
injury.
Thought that type 3 was like a combination between insulin resistance and cellular resistance to glucose. But interesting.
Yeah.
We learned something new from our budding physician here. So next on the agenda, and before we do move on, if you do suffer from erectile dysfunction and you've got a bit of a gut, you think, hey, my dad had diabetes, mother had diabetes, come check us out at www.jensclinic.co.za and we might be able to help you. Next up on the agenda, we're going to be discussing an interesting story coming out of the United States. So there was a woman basically kept as a human incubator on life support. Her name is Ariana Smith, and she resides in the state of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
The story is she had these chronic headaches, and she was regularly seeing a neurologist.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, her level of consciousness became reduced. She was having these persistent headaches. I'm not sure why she didn't get further investigations.
Mm.
But by the time she got investigated, it was found that she had multiple infarcts together with bleeds. It could have been something congenital that she was born with. But inevitably, she was declared brain dead. However, she was also found pregnant at that time. And in the state of Georgia, any pregnancy that's discovered over 6 weeks cannot mm-hmm. be terminated. And so the doctors, whether by their choice or they were prompted by law, had to keep this woman alive because in the state of Georgia, they do not allow terminations after 6 weeks. And so they basically are keeping this woman alive in order to inevitably deliver this fetus.
Mm.
So, thoughts? This is one of those, back in med school when they had those like those discussions about
those ethical dilemmas.
Ethical dilemmas using all these ethical principles.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean.
So, my initial thought, you know, is so if this person had had multiple infarcts, is already in ICU, meaning, I mean, we're dealing with someone who's technically not there anymore, but we have a possible fetus that we could save. I'm just obviously leaving the leak, you know, the abortion right, laws and everything. I honestly don't think it's a bad move personally. I mean, if the woman was the reason why they were having infarcts was because they were pregnant, and which is possible because I mean it's a hypercoagulable state. So you know, if they could prove
basically
that,
it makes the blood thicker.
Yes.
So pregnancy can actually make you prone to
lot.
Get clots.
It induce a lot. Like, I mean, I've seen, sorry, just to divert, but I see a lot of, you know, pregnant women who become blind, you know, glaucoma patients, pregnant, then they just quickly become blind.
From infarcts.
Remember, they can also get hypertension as well,
you know,
from preeclampsia.
Yes, so it could have been pregnancy.
Complication.
It would be weird, like, that early on, but yes, definitely possible.
Yeah.
Definitely
but
possible.
Higher intravascular volume as well, you know, it's things that could have been there that has now been unmasked or, pretty much now. It's
definitely.
Like a shown.
Definitely.
Yeah. So,
so your opinion, what's
so
your opinion?
So my opinion is, I think it's the
save
right
a
thing
life.
To do. Save
okay.
a life.
Vish, your opinion?
We
have to have one devil's advocate
here. Is this your like ethical consideration or like legal consideration? Or?
I think ethically. That's why I didn't involve anything legally.
Sure, yeah. I suppose we also don't know what the laws are of the state in Georgia. Yeah.
Let's pretend this was South Africa.
Yeah.
But somehow, they implemented a law that didn't allow termination. Because essentially, that's why they're keeping her. They're not keeping whether this child is ever going to... here's my thinking. This fetus, we don't know whether the mother actually wanted this pregnancy or not. That I'm not sure of. We can maybe check if she's actually wanting this pregnancy or not. Or this pregnancy was an unwanted one.
Mm.
But more than that...
So it's obviously a non-viable pregnancy at the moment.
Yeah, currently you cannot deliver a baby at 6 weeks or even 3 months. It's going to take at least at the even if you want to deliver like premature, only at like 6 months.
Six, 7 months.
Yeah,
six,
different seven centers months. Yeah, have different
so protocols. In South Africa, we'd worry about resources. Mm. We'd be like, now we're going to keep an ICU patient for six months where we've got other more... Mm. Suitable candidates. So that's in a South African context.
Suitable candidates.
Suitable, because we have, I know it's hard to say, but okay, we are in essence using this woman's body to incubate this baby. The baby's going to get born. I know this is not really an ethical consideration, but this baby's going to be born an orphan, or we don't know where the father is.
I think again, possibly ethically, like for example, if the patient had come in corpus mentis or hadn't or per se hadn't actually said what she wants in terms of the pregnancy and suddenly had to intubate and put an induced coma and she was in ICU, again, that's another ethical consideration of now. Because the thing is, you can keep somebody on life support, on a ventilator, on inotropes if need be, on ECMO, and they can technically still be alive. Like, alive.
Alive, as in their heart is still pumping. Yeah.
But, would it be a family member that now says, no, we don't want you to switch off the ventilator? Then, you know, in that situation now, can you still now pull the plug, or would you now have to keep that?
Mm.
Because it could even be a situation where, you know, a family member has then said, no, we're not ready to pull the plug yet.
Could be. And that it might be like sensationalism where everybody else is like, oh, they just want to save the fetus. And
if you think about it again, how often, like, you also keep brain dead patients alive for, okay, not this long. But if a patient or someone is an organ donor, you would keep them on ventilatory support until you can do a organ harvest or, you know, harvest the organs.
100%, yeah.
So, I mean, technically, you're keeping the patient alive for some benefit.
You're harvesting the baby.
So, I mean, is it comparable?
Nas, what do you think?
So, I mean, it's also the beginning. Imagine if this thing was preventable. Let's say she came in with preeclampsia, right? And then she now had eclampsia and she had a stroke or something like that. And I don't know if those guys in those countries, they actually do termination at a later age, a later gestation to save the mother. In South Africa, mother is priority, right?
Yeah.
Baby's out.
Baby's
out as soon as there's complications, right?
Yeah.
So what if they had not taken out the baby and they just let the complications happen, right? And then now she's brain dead. So... Also, do we know the gestation? Because that also matters a lot. If it's like term, then you can take it out. If it's not far from term, then it doesn't make sense. If it's like 6 weeks, you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So I remember during our rotation in Guyane, I can't remember which Guyane it was, but I remember they would say you can always replace a baby, but you can't replace mommy.
Mm.
So that's why we prioritize the mom over the baby. Not that we just want.
But here you can't replace the mom.
Yes. No. I'm just saying.
The priority in our context here in South Africa
is mother over child.
So, I work obviously in the emergency department. We had a case. We actually discussed it on the podcast where a mother came in and she had gone into cardiac arrest. And the consideration for doing a perimortem, like while the person is dying perimortem cesarean section is to remove the baby, not to save the baby, but to save the mother. Mm. Because whatever extra demands that baby is taking from the mother could potentially save her life.
Mm.
So by relieving those demands, whether it's the oxygen supply, the blood supply to the fetus, whether it could be compressing one of her major vessels that doesn't allow her heart to fill, all of these are reasons to remove the baby, not to save the baby, but to save the mother.
Mm. And you can't do that in America. In America, they'd say you killed the baby.
That's actually what I was thinking. Yeah, the legality. Even here, how do you guys work around it?
Yeah.
Like, who makes the decision to say...
An unborn child in America.
Yeah, I mean, here, hey, you can go... You can get a TOP anyway.
Wasn't there that case
No, but I'm saying with your case. So who was the person who said, guys, we need to do a perimortem here? We need to
save
mom.
So we were about to. So it was our decision as the emergency physicians to make the decision to do the perimortem Caesar. But we did want to call the gynae because we were like, listen, this is not our forte. We're gonna go do this. And you know how it is. They already busy cutting a Caesar. They in theater already. So there was a delay. But we inevitably decided this woman she was cold. Mm. She had been in cardiac arrest for too long. And that is not something you don't want to go in when you feel like it's going to be pointless. You don't want to basically butcher a woman. Cut her open, take a fetus out in less than ideal circumstances. So we inevitably, all of us, we had the consultant on the phone, the specialist, and we spoke to gynae and they said, look, we're running. We're going to come as soon as possible, but get the set ready. And when we spoke to the consultant and we got the history from the family, she had already been gone for too long.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't have made a difference and we would have butchered her. We would have not saved the baby. But that baby potentially was viable because of the size, you know, you feel the symphysis fundal height. So that was at least 32 weeks.
Mm. So you guys could have even...
So we could have, but we realized, I mean, there was no... She had no pulse. She was cold. This baby, we were going to pull out a dead baby, essentially.
Mm.
And that wasn't ideal. So... Yeah, I mean, look, it's a tough one, this case, because obviously if you can save another life, you know that one life is over, right?
Yes.
So we know that that life is over. The consideration is, can we save another life?
I think if resources are not an issue, I don't see a problem with it, to be
and
fair.
I think also consulting the family,
yeah,
that's also an important one. But I wonder in America, like, who holds the keys to the plug? Like, do the family, if the family say, I want to pull the plug, if she wasn't pregnant and they say pull the plug, they can do it, I assume.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But if now the fact that she's pregnant, is that why either the family is saying hold on or the state of Georgia
is saying no, hold on.
Is saying hold on, we don't allow. But technically, it's not an abortion.
Yes.
Yeah. If a mother gets hit by a car and the baby died, that's not an abortion.
Yes,
So the mother died from natural causes and now there's a fetus that is alive.
Yeah.
But it's crazy that they're going to keep this. They'll have to keep it for... They're not going to stop at 7 months. They're not going to stop at 6 months. They're going to wait till 9 months if they can.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
Nas, what's your final thoughts?
Let them keep it.
Let them keep it.
Let them
Vish?
Yeah, I think if it's the...
Santa?
In South Africa, we probably wouldn't keep.
Mm. Flush.
But anywhere else, maybe.
In South Africa, we know. Didn't you have a case recently, Vish, you were telling us about a termination, that interesting story about a termination.
Yes, yeah.
So it was actually a bit a while ago, about a year maybe or so. But again, like, termination of pregnancies is still, I think, a bit of a taboo or, like, you know.
Even though there's easy access.
Yeah, even though there's easy access in the hospitals.
It's
A lot of patients, again, if it's under age.
But, sorry to cut you, but also our cultural nuances when it comes to that. Like, some of the nurses, you go there and they're like, again, you're here.
Yeah.
No, that's, yeah.
100%. And then now they're like, now people are like, we'd rather go back street.
I'm actually thinking back to internship days and, like, it's like, deja vu, like, you can, like, I just, like, remember, like, people saying, again, you here, and this, and that, and you're like, You know, that's so uncalled for. But
yeah.
I think there's a lot of different reasons why there's backstreet abortions. I think there's also multiple different methods. I mean, we all know about the cytotec or misoprostol, which induces uterine contractions, which they use. It's actually an off-label use of the misoprostol.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other, I have seen other, or like heard of other, like backstreet abortion techniques, you know?
Yeah.
And this is some of the things I've heard, but you know, they would insert almost like a hook or
like a cord,
like
hanger,
a wire or like a hanger
into the cervix,
into the uterus, trying.
So that's
to,
the mouth of the womb. Yes, that's not the vagina. It goes into the vagina, into the cervix, and then
And then obviously trying to again, like, not sure what the gestation or how far the pregnancy was, but almost trying to like remove the contents of the womb, of the intestine, of the uterus. So that's obviously the fetus, you know, just trying to like induce a, like a miscarriage, basically, you know. And in doing this, it seemed as if the patient then started not doing well. Patient eventually got sent via the ambulance to the hospital. And when the patient arrived at the hospital, the patient was assessed as having an acute abdomen, distended abdomen, and was taken to theater. So that obviously can be from bleeding, from ruptured uterus, which, I mean, it's things that can happen, but like you don't initially think that, you know?
Mm.
And I was actually called to theater by one of the gynaes that took the patient to theater. And they were unsure of, you know, like what, how far this this had gone. Because on their end, they saw that the uterus was ruptured, which means this object had gone through the uterus and now into the abdomen.
Yo.
So
they're not sure what exactly it was.
Not sure, yeah. But, I mean, when I got there, had a look, examined, and intra-op obviously saw that this, whatever thing that used had avulsed the ureter off the kidney. And
so that's the pipe that joins the kidney to the bladder.
Yeah,
it has to be a cord hanger. It has to be that sharp.
It had
end.
To have been. And fortunately, I mean,
how deep
part of
is
the kidney
that?
Was avulsed as well. But fortunately, the vessels
so it, like,
were still attached
to the kidney.
Fortunately, the vessels were still attached to the aorta and the vena cava. I mean, luckily, that would have been game over. But we ended up doing a nephrectomy. I mean, that entire ureter was non-viable. The part where it had ruptured off from the kidney was also non-viable.
Yo.
So, yeah.
Crazy.
I mean, things can go very
door.
Bad.
Yeah. You know? From a backdoor abortion.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, we are very liberal in our laws here in South Africa. I'm sure, Nassim, you in primary healthcare, you obviously see a lot of women that I'm sure want to see.
Up till 13 weeks, no questions asked. I think up till 20 weeks, they can do it, but you might need a
with the doctor.
With
I think.
A doctor.
Yeah, with consultation.
And more than 20, I think, is two doctors.
It must be like defects.
Look, obviously, our primary healthcare needs to change its view, so have all our staff having the same idea of this is a healthcare measure that's going to prevent further complications down the line. And that starts with contraception. And abortion should not be used as a form of contraception.
Yeah. Mm.
It's not something that I think as healthcare professionals, you don't want to advocate for it, but you don't want to limit people's access to it either.
Yeah. Yeah. Because of the situations. I mean, I think we've covered some of them. I mean, Vish covered some of them as well. Mm. You know, some of them are unwanted babies. Mm. You know, maybe it's a rape case, you know. Some of them are congenital abnormalities that have been detected that mom knows or the family has decided they won't be able to handle some of this.
Yeah.
There's so many, you know, situations around all of this. So I think a woman's health is their, you know, their problem, and they're the ones that can decide what they want, you know.
I mean, there's been, I'm thinking back to like internship days now, you know, that was, I mean, I'm very involved with the gynaes, but I mean, back when I was actually in, like working in a gynae department, but I've seen a few times where gentlemen would, I mean, a partner or couples would come through and say like, you know, we like having an infertility issue or problem. Sometimes even nowadays, you know, like I see gentlemen for like infertility workup, and sometimes, I mean, the woman had actually had a TOP or some complication that led to having a TAH or hysterectomy. And
the partner and doesn't know.
Partner doesn't know. And, you know, it could be like the staff in the hospital may remember this patient, like, you know, like what's going on here, because like we did a TAH on you.
That's, you know, a hysterectomy.
And, you know, it's, they have a new partner now. They're trying to conceive a child, and it's just a mess, you know. Yeah,
they don't know what to say, how to explain all of this. So they play
along. I'm sure all of you guys have seen that somewhere.
Yeah, it's a very common. It's a very
common.
I think another thing that it actually used to highlight to me is maybe we're just not counseling patients enough. Maybe you know, because I mean, for someone to come to that extent, to even come to the same hospital, stand next to you, and say, "Please, why am I not falling pregnant?" I doubt they, you know, they're crooking anyone. They might actually not have understood. Maybe at that time, you know, life was whatever. Or maybe life was good. Yeah. Maybe they were married back then and they had their two kids and they thought that was it. Now they're in a new relationship.
I think that the partner probably has forced them. Like, no, we have to go to the hospital and check. Yeah. And it's not a nice situation to be in.
100%. So, look, we're almost wrapped with our first episode. I think we are going to do some reaction videos. So we're going to react to these videos that our producers have chosen for us. Let's see what you guys wanted us to see.
There's no coincidence she got rid of her jowls, hooded eyes, and deep-set smile lines around the same time Khloe Kardashian was named one of the world's slowest agers. Also, absolutely no coincidence that this year we saw Meghan Trainor age in reverse, and Hailey Bieber, despite Justin, got her Vogue cover. As the founder of a multi-million dollar skincare brand, I could tell you exactly what they're doing, but they can tell you for themselves.
I'm trying to biohack my body. So anything that'll help me age backwards, I'm into it. I've just learned about the NADs. I was like, make me Hailey Bieber.
You heard the Hailey Bieber reference right there.
Do you think that doing like NAD multiple days in a row is...
I feel like we're just, yeah, really big on our health journey for sure.
So it makes for a great friendship. I'm going to NAD for the rest of my life and I'm never going to age.
And NAD is it. The reason all your favorite celebs on like People Magazine and E! News look 10 to 15 years younger than they actually are. It's this molecule we have a ton of when we're younger, but as it declines with age, you notice collagen loss, like sagging skin, lower energy levels, and a severe dependency on caffeine, worse metabolism, worse brain function, and poor memory. And in the past, boosting NAD was only available through those expensive and painful infusions the celebrities get. And all the NAD boosting supplements on the market used weak versions of NAD that were broken down by stomach acids and peed out. Until this brand Catacor, formerly Ruse Research, used true NAD, not a precursor, so it rivals the strength of those expensive infusions. Also have a trademark on this liposomal delivery system. It just means your body fully absorbs the anti-aging power of this NAD. And that's why not just my clients, majority of the 660,000 people who have purchased this report better energy levels in as little as 2 to 3 days and improvements to the skin by week 3. And you can get these online. It's just way cheaper on TikTok.
Yeah, I think this guy was trying to sell his product.
Yeah. This guy's an NAD.
Look,
I'm not sure if you guys have seen Brian Johnson.
Yes. Brian Johnson, the guy who's trying to biohack himself and
They call him the vampire. But he's aging in. Is he aging in reverse? He's just aging slower than the normal But that has a lot to do with genetics as well.
But I mean, even the type of lifestyle this guy lives, man. I remember watching.
The one with J.C. James West. There was a video. I think there's...
No. Yeah. He's done a lot. He's even got one on Netflix.
Okay, I think I watched like one episode there. I mean, crazy. From the morning. Yes,
from the morning is a routine.
I'm talking about like
red light therapy.
Red light therapy. Yes, all these insane
anything things. That has oxygen. What do you think about this, Nas?
What, this NAD or Brian Johnson?
Like, well, Brian Johnson, but we can reference the NAD as well. Because I'm assuming he's also on NAD.
He's on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What does NAD stand for?
Nicotinamide something.
Nicotinamide.
So, for NAD, the idea is that it's like, it's a free radical vacuum thing, right? So, it goes and binds to the free radicals in the body, right? So, the theory is that free radicals in your body cause damage to all your cells, right?
Yeah.
So if you can have something to go and attach to it, it's like an anti-inflammatory kind of thing.
Mm.
It would help and to clear that out.
So actually higher metabolism actually is associated with faster aging.
Mm.
Ah, okay.
A high metabolism or slow.
So
metabolism.
Then I'm going to be fine metabolism. Forever then. I'm going to outlive all of you guys.
Wow, okay.
I got the yeah. slowest metabolism on this planet.
It doesn't make sense, actually.
I mean, no, obviously compounding other factors, but yeah.
Yeah. If your cells are generating, metabolism.
If your cells are regenerating more often,
yeah.
But there's all these fads. Like people are putting it in their drips, and people are overdoing things that are very expensive and for minimal benefit.
Yeah, like I know.
Like you never know if you're just going to get hit by a bus tomorrow.
Also, I'm always very. So what?
Don't do it.
Just live your life.
YOLO then. But like with this, I can see when celebs start using something and they're promoting it actively online and whatever, they've probably got shares
yes,
in companies 100%, like this.
Yeah.
They are in a 0.0001% of the world's population. What they are doing for their health is not just, it's not like Hailey Bieber's just taking NAD and she's getting fillers and Botox.
Plastic
and
surgery.
And you can see all of them. They've all had some kind of.
So then to just say it's one little capsule.
But
that's
the thing is, it's also.
It's
another thing of trying to look younger versus actually. Because remember, you skin wise, you can do a lot of things to look or have the appearance of being younger.
Of course.
You can get a hair transplant and look younger, but. Ultimately, I mean, if your insides are aging rapidly, if your insides are aging rapidly, it does. It's not like you are not aging. You're still aging. It's just that you can't see it on your skin or on your face.
Yeah, because I should be bald.
It's not aging.
By now,
it's
not.
More, yeah, it's more
but,
like a
no,
cover.
What Brian Johnson is doing is actually anti-aging.
For him. What he is trying to achieve is like reverse or slow it down.
Slow it down, yeah.
But yeah, let's see the next video.
This I can say is true about ortho. Yeah. No, I'm joking.
So what? It looks like he was removing a intramedullary nail.
Looks like it, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's,
I don't know, what were we supposed to react to this video? Yeah, he's removing a nail.
This is actually ortho work.
This is actually what orthopedic
exactly.
surgeons do.
This is what we think, and this is what they actually do.
Yeah, they just have hammers, nails, chisels, whatever they need.
They are the carpenters of the medical world. Like, just like we are the plumbers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've been hunting me down for years, man. The corridors. These guys.
The orthos.
With all those guns.
Yeah.
It's such a small organ.
Like, you must be an ortho. I'm like, nah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the stereotypical orthopedic surgeon is a very large frame, butch. Afrikaans. A lot of Afrikaans. A lot of Afrikaans guys do orthopedics. And I mean, the stereotype amongst in the medical fraternity is that they're dumb. Like, they can't read ECGs.
No, I don't think
they... That's the stereotype. I'm not saying that they are dumb. I'm just saying that...
They look at x-rays and decide, no, those guys are smart, man. Those guys are good.
Yeah, no. But I shout out to you, orthos. I have a lot of respect for you. Without you, we would have a lot of limping people. So thank you. And I think that's all the videos we're going to be reacting to today. It's been a lovely episode. I think we covered quite a bit, two very big topics. We talked about diabetes and sexual health and function and why we'd rather have HIV. Not to say you need to get HIV, but why we would rather have it. And then we spoke about a tragic story from a lady in Georgia and the ethical principles around keeping her alive. Finally, we reacted to two videos. And that's the episode for this week. My name is Soil Essa. Join us next week. Peace.
You know me already.
Dr. Vishen, I'm the guest.
Naseem Sharif.
We'll see you next week.